Robin Miller. It's another week in IndyCar news for you and I. Last week, I think the big topic, the one that actually continues to be sustained, is one about a certain Mr. Fernando Alonso. Last week was fun, just seeing everyone's reaction, how unexpected it was, and how I think most people, clearly not all, as we learned this week, but most people believe that Fernando coming to Indianapolis to compete as an active Formula One driver, two-time world champion, it's kind of a big deal. The news certainly extended this week, though, because as we read in one widely distributed opinion column, not everybody sees the interest or gets why this is a big thing. Curious, you know, I know you told me you've read about some of the reactions, some of the comments from legends and whatnot. What comes to mind? What aren't we seeing, or what do others maybe not understand about how cool this is?
The person who wrote the story covers NASCAR 90% of the time. She comes to some IndyCar races, and sometimes when you write something like that, you want people to pay attention to you. You want somebody. You want people talking about, oh my God, you see what they said? Oh, whereas 99.9% of the people that care about racing, that are race fans or their lives revolve around racing, think this is a cool deal, and Mario pretty much took her to task. I mean, I talked to Nigel Roebuck, probably the senior writer in Formula One. I mean, Alonso has been talking about this for 10 to 12 years to him, because I got to run the 8500. I just got to do it, you know. Clark did it in Stewart and Hill, and I'm Mansell. I want to be the next guy that does it. So the fact that he's only 35, the fact that Emerson Fittipaldi started his kart career when he was 38, and the guy's been saddled with this sled of a car and engine for the last couple of years, he's chomping at the bit to do this. And it's not publicity, and it's not money, and it's his personal preference, because he's a professional and he wants to be challenged. And I think that was what was cool about Kurt Busch. When you step out of your comfort zone and you come to the Indianapolis Motor Speedway and you've never been in an Indy car like Busch had, and for Alonso, he's never been on an oval. I mean, that takes some big cahoons, and that's what these guys got. And I think that's what's kind of cool about Alonso, because he's clearly pretty excited about it. And that's, to see that it's great for racing in general. I think, you know, we both said that last week. But it's great for international motorsports. It's great for IndyCar races. It's great for the Indy 500. It's ticket sales. They've actually shown a spike in ticket sales in 8 days at the Speedway. I was talking to somebody at the ticket office today. It was like, oh my God, as soon as the Alonso thing came out. So there's a lot of people that want to see this guy run.
And as I've mentioned to a couple of folks, if a writer is writing their truth, you know, in an opinion piece, if they crap all over something, even if it's a really unpopular thought and people rip them to shreds afterwards, look, I might not agree with whatever a person has to say in their opinion column, but I can tell you, if they're writing their truth, if they're saying something that they truly think and believe, I can't fault them, because at least they're being honest and exposing themselves to whatever criticism that may follow. So I can't criticize Jenna for what she wrote, provided she was writing her truth. Just the critical backlash that I've seen has been one that, you know, pretty much says the same statement over and over again. Do you realize there is a world outside of North America? Do you realize that there's like a Europe and an Asia and an Africa and a whole bunch of other places that saw this news, couldn't believe it, and are fired up to watch Indy 500, if not for the first time, for the first time in a long time? So, granted, will Fernando Alonso competing at the Indy 500 move the proverbial needle massively within, you know, the continental 48 from coast to coast? I don't think so. I don't think we're going to talk about we've doubled the ABC TV ratings because Fernando was there. No, absolutely not. But I don't know if any of us expected that. What I took away from this when we learned about it was, wow, for the first time in a really long time, little boys, little girls in Spain, England, Belgium, wherever, who might not have known about the Indy 500, but follow Alonso, follow Formula One, love Formula One, will have a reason to care. And knowing how important Europe has been to IndyCar, dating back to the very first Indianapolis 500. This has always been an international series. Might not have always traveled abroad, but the drivers, manufacturers, you name it, there's always been a massive European influence in IndyCar. We have had that wane a bit, come and go. Things have been a little bit stale there in recent years. So at least for me, I look at this Alonso thing and say, hey, you know what? If this makes more young drivers want to come over and compete, bring their money, bring their sponsors, bring their talent, teams want to come over, sponsors that might look at, you know, this IndyCar vehicle as something that they would have never considered before. If any of these things happen, if the TV packages wherever in Europe, in Asia, and the rest of the world that might care improve as a result of this, you know, we're not pretending that this is going to transform the globe into loving IndyCar more than F1, but there's potential. And I think the excitement of that potential by this one guy doing this, that's the take-home message.
Well, and not to mention, it was just in the last year, I was reading, maybe it was Autosport or Motorsport or what, that Lewis Hamilton finally surpassed Alonso in the fan vote as the most popular. Now think about that. This guy hadn't won a race in 3 years because he's been in one of the worst car engine combinations on the planet, and yet he's still been the most popular driver. And, you know, it's just, to me, it's when Clark and Hill and Stewart and Renton and Brabham and those guys came over here, it added so much to the race itself, and those guys, and the credibility of those guys' resumes, and the fact that it was such a cool time. And like you said, I mean, it's, you know, would it be great if McLaren came over here and ran again? Absolutely. I think you've talked to Zach Brown recently maybe about that.
Yeah, and that's, you know, it's another thing which maybe a few years down the road, Zach was, when we spoke this week, a little bit of a follow-up about how the reaction to the Alonso news at Bahrain last weekend and whatnot, but the nugget that I loved was one of the members of the board there at McLaren stating last week that, you know, we're also looking at IndyCar as an entrant. And, I think a lot of us, our ears kind of perked up knowing how we need more teams in the series. So spoke with Zach about that. Pretty clear that the struggles and troubles with, McLaren, but with the Honda in the back of the McLaren chassis this year and even last year, it's clearly set back any ambitions for getting the McLaren team into IndyCar as a full-season entrant. As Zach said, you know, we're going to need to get to a place where we're able to win Formula One races before we can really justify tackling anything in IndyCar. And, you know, if I was in his position, knowing that he is truly the most passionate person there about IndyCar, knowing that he has such great ties and roots to the series, you can see that he would be in a bit of a bind. You know, I know he would love to commission that right now and have the factory McLaren team running the full season, but obviously with their F1 program spinning out of control a little bit, you got to make sure that is functioning properly before you add on another new challenge. We also spoke a little bit about engines and whether they would look at considering, you know, building a McLaren engine to become an engine supplier. And a little more vague on that answer than, you'd hoped. Of course, you want to hear, yes, we're building it right now, it's coming. But nonetheless, you look at the fact that for what they are, as not only a racing team, but also an automotive constructor, there's some potential there, definite potential for Zach and Mark Miles and Jay Fry to discuss in the months and hopefully years ahead to get them into IndyCar. That would be huge. Beyond Alonso, having McLaren on the grid, I think that could actually end up being the biggest potential game changer for the series. So the other cool thing, Robin, is we're going to have Alonso at Barber this weekend. So not at Long Beach, which is this, you know, nice, tony, street environment, cool, hipster, whatever. We're talking down home, Leeds, Alabama. My lovely wife is from Alabama. So there are some wonderful products to come out of that state. I just don't know if I ever thought that was going to be the place where Fernando saw his first IndyCar race. What are you thinking about heading into that?
He's probably never been to Rusty's Barbecue, but we're going to work on that. That'll be one of our projects over the weekend. But I think the thing that's interesting is that he wants to get as comfortable around this environment as he can, and coming over here and hanging out with the Andretti guys and watching practice and qualifying. I think he's going to be in the NBC booth for a little bit on Sunday, which is cool.
You think can get him to do the grid run with you? That would be awesome.
Doubtful. But if we could get him to Rusty's Barbecue, it's a start. See, if he liked it, then we could say, well, listen, I got another deal for you. But, you know, I think it's interesting because when Mansell came over, there were 90 people at his first test, 90 media from around the world at his first test. And it looks like his first test will probably not be till the first week in May because of, you know, back-to-back races and his schedule. But do I expect that kind of a turnout? Probably not, because Mansell was the reigning Formula One champ when he turned his back on F1 and came to kart. But I think I think the press room this May is going to be full of a lot of real Euro journals covering this thing, and I don't know. I just think it's kind of cool. He's going to be in good old Leeds, Alabama, and I think when a guy like that, and by the way, I said in the mailbag that he's making $20 million a year, and Nigel Roebuck said, "Well, you're a little off. He's making $40 million a year." So $40 million a year. So, and Honda pays half his salary, the Buck said. So. I don't know. I just think it's an intriguing time, and it gives us nobody was really sure what the 101st Indy 500 how tickets were going to sell, what we're going to talk about, and now here's this ready-made built-in story that you could never have dreamed of.
The other thing which is fun is I know that our mutual friend and former colleague David Malcher, we all have expressed not concern, but just wanting to make sure we put on our best clothes, put on our Sunday finest, knowing that. We have Alonso coming over, and I know there's been some discussion behind the scenes of, okay, so he's going to sit down for a press conference, then they're going to open it up to the hard card credentialed media, and, you know, look, you and I know your favorite person in the media center is Mr. Two Questions, and there are some others who, you know, are great characters among the media, but I also know that it wouldn't surprise me if IndyCar, instead of picking the person who raises their hand first or second, wouldn't surprise me if they were a little bit more choosy about who they hand the microphone to ask Fernando a question, because as you noted, what was it, for Alexander Rossi's very first question when he was introduced to the media at spring training last year in 2016, the very first question he was asked, not about his Formula One pedigree, not about his dream of Formula One and is coming over to IndyCar a step down or step up, what do you think your chances are? None of that. Alex, how would you like to be called, Alex or Alexander? And he just kind of looked around the room like, seriously, this is what I have to look forward to. So I think IndyCar is going to be smart and keep the microphone restricted to those that they know are going to ask proper questions.
Well, you're optimistic. Well, that remains to be seen. I think the most important thing is that, you know, Roebuck said he's just a really nice guy, and that's what Servi has told us, the same thing, and everybody really seems to like the guy, which is, you know, Mansell didn't have that. I mean, you know, the Formula One guys were so... They actually, I went back and looked at a column that Nigel Roebuck did, and they said the very first Formula One race in 1993, somebody stood up in the press room as they were getting ready to start, and they go, "You know what? You know what this means? He can't win the race. He's not here." And they all cheered. Well, they're not going to do that. I mean, Alonso's evidently just the opposite. The media love him, and the fans love him. So it should be a fun month and a half.
My boy J.R. Hildebrand is going to be watching Sunday's race from the timing stand compared to being in the car and watching it first person on track. We've got Zach Veach getting called up. I think just about everybody expected that to happen, knowing that he had a successful test with the team, was working all throughout the offseason to try and put together a deal, actually wanting to be in the car that JR is in full time. We know he has said he doesn't expect this to be more than Barber. Definitely thinks Jer will be back for Phoenix, but Jer hasn't had the start to the year that he wanted, obviously, at St. Pete or at Long Beach. What do you think, Robin, about, you know, a guy getting his second shot in IndyCar? Almost never happens. Having the first two races really not be as fulfilling or as strong as you wanted, then having to sit out the third. Any concerns of this being a ongoing downward spiral for JR, or do you think he'd be able to shake this off?
I don't think anybody expected him to set the world on fire on road courses and street circuits. I think they're just thinking he's going to shine on the ovals, and he's going to, as the season gets going, he's going to get better and better on road courses and street circuits. But I don't think anybody expects him to be in the fast six, or maybe even in the fast 12. Maybe near the end of the year when they get to Sonoma, which is his track. I mean, that's you'd expect him to do well there, but he's, you know, I mean, he had a really good test at Phoenix, so I think that's the race he doesn't want to miss, because, you know, that's his forte, is running ovals. And Little Veach, last week at Long Beach, he was working for the IMS network, so I think that's he's working the IMS radio network, and now he's in the car, which is he's just such a great kid, and you just hope that he can match that test that he had at Sonoma for Ed with a good result.
You think he's getting paid more or less being in the car this weekend than he did on IMS Radio Long Beach?
Oh, it's probably if he gets his expenses paid, Ed'll pay his expenses. He's already going to be probably way ahead of what he made at Long Beach.
He doesn't look like much of a drinker, so I don't know if trying to pay him off in fuzzies.
He doesn't look like he eats or drinks.
Yeah, we gotta. Wherever you take Alonso, take Veach. We need to fatten that kid up a little bit. So, you know, another thing we've been talking about too, Robin, is Honda and this, I don't know, strange but really unexpected start to the season. I spoke with Will Power about this, spoke with a lot of drivers, and everyone's still kind of baffled. And granted, I mean, if you look at what we were predicting, and I think almost everybody was predicting coming into the season, you know, we all said, okay, this is going to be another Penske romp. Honda's, you know, how could they be any better, knowing the aero kits are frozen, the engine development rules don't allow very much this year. You know, 2016 they could do a lot, 2017 they can do very little. How could it change? And this is one of the reasons that I hate writing previews, because mine are always wrong. But
I said Will Power's going to win half the races and clinch a championship by July. I mean, yeah, or whatever I said. I can't remember what I said. But, you know, you have some theories about why Honda's better, because, well, like you said, what could they do internally to the engine? What can they do? Was it all aero kit thanks to Craig Hampson and the Ganassi boys and Bourdais and Dixon? I mean, what was it?
So here's what I think, and I've floated this across a couple drivers, and they haven't, at least they were kind, I didn't say I was a total idiot, but this is my theory, and it'll take a minute. But so in 2012, you and I remember, I think we started calling it Black Friday, Friday at St. Petersburg, first day of the brand new Dallara DW12 era, first day of this new turbocharged twin turbo 2.2 liter V6 engine formula, Chevy, Honda, Lotus. We forgot about Lotus, and that's okay, we should, but Honda, with Ganassi as their anchor team, their big shining team, got their ass handed to them. Honda's on that opening day, forget all the preseason testing, you know, first day to see what everyone really has. Hondas were slow. Didn't have the straight line speed, didn't have the acceleration off the corners, didn't have the torque, and they were blown up a ton. So it was kind of every nightmare manifested in one day. Chip Ganassi went absolutely ballistic. You know, it's a good thing he didn't have firearms, because he would have been killing people from Honda. And from what we heard throughout the rest of the year, you know, Honda as a company said, hey, we're not going to start off a season like this again. So when you come back in 2013, do whatever you can to make the engines better, obviously, but we're not going to be slow and unreliable. The reliability part we can manage by dialing things back. And if you look at what Honda did, 2013, 14, 15, even 16, tend to start off the year a little bit slow, definitely with Chevy jumping out, being not only strong, but imposingly strong. Then by the time we get to Indy, where Honda, would unleash its first real big development update to its engines and send those out to all their teams, we would see this big month of May jump in performance. But bottom line, coming off of this really unexpected and surprisingly bad start to 2012, from 2013 on, a genuine conservative approach, at least compared to Chevy, and then by May, after they've gotten through those first couple of rounds, that's when we start to see the power. That's when we see Honda start to rally back. I think coming into 2017, Robin, with this aero kit freeze, with the limited amount of development that could be done during the off season, I think Honda definitely put a lot of money into finding as much as they could on the development side. But I also think they got rid of that conservative approach. I think they said, you know, we can't afford to dial the motors back if we want to be successful. So what have we found? A buttload of speed. Crazy, crazy power. You look at their really impressive top speeds, and then you also look at their really impressive corner exit trap numbers. You look at all kinds of data that says, wow, these guys are getting off the corners amazingly, they're running a lot of downforce, and they're putting up big top speed numbers. And coincidentally, they're also blowing motors up. So again, I'm not saying my theory's correct, but if I look at how things have changed this year, it looks to me like that conservative approach that has really pegged them back for the past 5 years or whatever it has been all but abandoned, and they're showing all their cards to start the season, and they're also blowing up a lot of motors. So I don't know if you've seen or gotten any of those feelings, but that's the closest thing I can attribute it to.
Nope, I asked one driver, and he said, I think it was a combination of a lot of things. He said they spent a whole lot of time in the wind tunnel with a 7-post shaker rig. He was talking about Ganassi. So, you know, he said, I think there was some things gained there too. So, you know, you just got to think that, you know, I mean, Will's pretty pragmatic anymore. He's like, you know, Ilmor and Chevy and Roger Penske will have, by May, we'll have an answer, and I think they probably will.
Well, let's close here on two last points. Our Indy 500 car count continuing to develop. That news, Robin, behind the scenes. Actually, folks, before he and I started recording here, we kind of compared notes on a couple of seats, which probably can't go into total specifics yet, but Robin will hopefully or likely have a story to put out here soon to put some names in seats here, but coming along. I don't have us at 33 locked in yet, but I'm definitely a lot more confident knowing that we have six Andretti cars and some others that are looking a little more solid than they were just a couple weeks ago.
I think we count 18 Hondas for sure, and at least 13 or 14 Chevys.
Yeah.
I mean, so it's, you know, it's 31 or 32, isn't it?
And we're getting there. You know, that we, as we've said all along, getting to that 33rd, and I don't mean, you know, potential, but actual, okay, we know it's going to happen with driver X and team X. We expect that's going to be the one that's a little harder to lock down. You know, when we last went into this in depth, it was, okay, we're at about 30, maybe 31. We're not sure how we're going to get those extra couple. Now, we're kind of looking at that last spot, maybe the last two spots, but it's going to be a little bit till we can, I think, say for sure who the 32nd is going to be, and definitely the 33rd.
Yeah, you always wonder is Junco's going to run two cars? Is he going to run one? And is Bob Lazier going to have a car? Or is it going to be Buddy, or is it going to be somebody else? I mean, there's a lot of questions still to be answered, so we're still a couple weeks away from May, so like I said, there'll always be 33. We know that. IndyCar will make sure that happens. I got to tell you one funny story about that. My phone rings this morning at 9:30.
Were you awake
yet?
It's Daniel
Sexton Gurney, which means that it's 6:30 in California. And I said, "What in the hell are you doing up so early?" He says, "I've been thinking about racing. I couldn't go to sleep last night. I was thinking I had some ideas. I guess I want to run some of them by you." And we talked for, I listened for 30 minutes. But just his ideas about, he's so concerned. He goes, "I'm 86 years old, you know, they're not going to listen to me, but I just want to see, innovation come back. And I want to see people using, because we were talking about just taking an idea and running with it. And he said, I pray that it happens again so people can appreciate how much fun we had in the 60s and 70s taking a chance and using our brain. And he goes, I just want to see that happen again. And it was just pretty, I wrote down everything he said, so I hope I can read my notes because it was pretty funny.
Yeah, and that's been something Dan's been trying to safeguard for a while, and I don't make enough time to write about that general topic as I should. But it's completely true. It's weird. I refer to this as the Stockholm syndrome in motor racing fairly often, in that spec racing, cost control, balance of performance, and this isn't just IndyCar, this is sports cars and whatnot, but in so many forms of racing that were once truly awesome. I mean, just wow. It was amazing to be there, to see the cars, to have curiosity of what was beneath the bodywork, the ideas, the ingenuity. It was this engineer on this team dreaming up an idea and another engineer on another team. And it wasn't just who we have in the car going out to fight on Sunday for 2 hours. It was my idea versus your idea. And all these things didn't cost a trillion zillion dollars. Some of them were, you know, just made out of bent up and shaped on the shop floor with aluminum or, you know, carbon, whatever it might be, but just ideas versus ideas. And I mean, that to me is ultimately the human spirit that drove this sport to be created. And it isn't a surprise to me that there are many reasons behind this, but it isn't a surprise to me that racing in general continues to decline in popularity, in viewing numbers, in the age of the viewers, in the amount of new viewers or new fans coming in. It isn't a surprise to me that those things are happening at a time where the sport is as restrictor-plated and spec-tireded and maximum displacement this and balance of performance that, where seemingly throughout the sport, not every area, but in way too many areas, the human spirit, the spirit of ingenuity and creation, the whole idea behind going to school, right? Or at least higher education. Hey, I want to be a scientist, and I want to find a cure for this, or I want to learn and reveal the mystery of that. I want to, whatever it is, these curiosities that I would hope for the most of us propel us each day, get us out of bed early, and have us doing like Dan at 86, laying in bed, thinking of ideas, dreaming of better things. It's not a surprise to me that when you drum so many of those things out of racing, when you put measures in the rule book that says everything has to be identical, you aren't allowed to touch this, you cannot do that, that people in general start to turn away. And I probably use this reference here, but I always use the LeBron James example. He's 6'8", a physical freak. You know, he's as wide as a barn. He's as strong as the Hulk. He is as tall as can be, the most physically dominant player of his kind the NBA has ever seen. And why is he the most popular and why is he the most celebrated? Because of these amazing attributes that he has. Well, what if the NBA said, all right, man, you need to squat down. We have a new rule that says nobody can be above 6'3" in the NBA.
That's
so
right, baby.
You need to kneel down, and so you're going to run slower, and you're not going to be able to dunk anymore. And you know, for you over here that are 5'11", we're going to give you risers in your shoes. To you know, but it just you start saying okay, and Steph Curry, you can hit a 3-pointer from 10 feet behind the 3-point line, and you've shown us that you can do that regularly. Well, you can now no longer shoot within 20 feet of the 3-point line because you're too accurate if you get any closer. And so that's going to bring your scoring average down and your efficiency. I mean, again, hey, you point guard over here, Isaiah Thomas, you're too fast. You cut through the lane too quickly and have too many layups. So we're actually going to weigh your shoes down so you can't run as fast because you go, well, how popular would the NBA be if the rulemakers there said, we are going to do all we can to strip the unique aspects out of our superstars How many people are going to show up to watch these games or tune in? I have to believe that number would be small and continue to decline. So it's a little bit of a little bit of a tangent here, but of course, you know, we don't want IndyCar, NASCAR, any of these sports to collapse because the rules are so open that manufacturers spin themselves into oblivion and depart after 2 or 3 years and the sport collapses. But there has to be a bigger picture view taken by the France families, IMSA's brass in general, and IndyCar's brass, and you name it, to say, okay, what do we need to do to make sure that people have a reason to tune in and care about more than just the personalities? You know, if NASCAR is a personality-driven sport, the cars are almost redundant. IndyCar, cars are cool. They do some pretty amazing things numerically, cornering forces and stopping distances and all that, but, you know, it doesn't, other than Kanaan and Elio and, you know, maybe one other person, there aren't a whole lot of stars for it to sell. You look at IMSA, they do have some really cool cars, but they're all spec in some way, shape, or form. They're all homologated. You can't mess with them. You really can't tweak them or develop them in any way, shape, or form. So, again, I think knowing that the rest of the world is one that tends to thrive on ingenuity and new ideas and embracing them in competition, when you start to strip the idea of competition out of a sport and say, nope, Steph, you got to shoot from this far away and you can't run this fast and you got to squat down so that everybody's as equal as possible, it just doesn't surprise me that we look in the grandstands and don't see as many people. Or we come out of a race and say, boy, that TV rating for whatever it was, whatever series, it's a little bit disappointing. So that's my little rant for the week, boys and girls.
I'm sorry. Now we added 40 minutes to that, so you have to cut that whole thing about Dan Gurney out. That'll be a whole segment next week.
Actually, I'm just going to slow it down so it plays longer and extends it. All right, well, the last item I had, and wrote about this a little bit talking with Power, our boy Willie P., he's sitting here 18th in points, Robin, after two races. So, granted, you know, we've got 17 races on the calendar. It's a long year. You know, he can come back. But I don't know if you or I would have expected after the first two rounds we'd go into the third round. Graham Rahal, P15. Tony Kanaan, P16. Alexander Rossi, P17. Will Power, P18. I mean, these are four guys that we expected to be, you know, if not top five, top eight, top, no more than, you know, those four, I think we absolutely expected to be inside the top eight, start the season and kind of sit there and fight among themselves. This is a little bit of a strange one, brother, because if any of these guys have another bad weekend this weekend, you know, you can really only give up about three a year, maybe four. And then you have to have, you know, really dynamic results elsewhere. But you can't give too many of these away before your title aspirations are gone. And we have four guys who we figured were going to be pretty deep into this championship hunt who they've already lost two. They don't have too many more to give up. What do you think about this, man? A little strange going into Barber.
Well, you know, I mean, Rossi had a... I mean, if he didn't blow up, he's going to finish first, second, or third. He was, and Graham was going to finish fifth. And Will had his problems. But, I mean, Will can run off three or four wins in a row. Like, I don't think... It was always like Dixon's slow start. He can always make it up. I just think it's, you know, Coyne's leading, and Schmidt-Peterson's up there, and Ed Jones is doing a hell of a... It's made it fun to watch and to try and figure out what's going on. But, you know, a lot of racing to go. It'll be fun to watch. It'll be, you know, the Pagenaud Graham Rahal show last year might be one of my favorite road races of the last 15 years. Hopefully it'll be something similar to that this weekend.
Amen to that. Well, the one person we didn't speak about was Ryan Hunter Ray, who gave us some pretty cool thoughts about Alonso coming in, and also commented on Lewis Hamilton talking about wanting to do the 500 and whatnot. So we didn't delve into that too much. So I'm actually just going to roll that interview in with Hunter Ray at the end of our little show here. So, Robin, I'm going to have to envy you from afar in Barber. I have some family stuff, good stuff, to tend to this weekend, so I won't be making this trip, so I'll see you in Phoenix. But enjoy yourself, and we will now hear the dulcet tones of one Ryan Hunter Ray.
So I'm looking at this cool Indy 500 lineup and thinking to myself, well, of all the drivers on the Andretti Autosport team, there's one guy that has more experience than anybody, and has won the race. When you hear about stuff like, hey, Alonso's coming to the 500, and we've got a rookie in Jack Harvey coming in, are you stoked? Or knowing that you're probably going to be leaned on in some capacity to share knowledge, be, you know, a sounding board, educator, etc.? Or is there also a side that says, you know, I need to go there and win a race. So how do I balance trying to be the good team player with, you know, having the same selfish objective that 33 other or 32 other drivers will have?
No, I mean, I think it's a great opportunity for the team in many ways, and it's certainly good for the sport. It reaffirms that the Indy 500 is the greatest race in the world, has only gained strength in reaffirming that. So I think it's a great opportunity for the team. Certainly look forward to working with my new teammates. I think we've become accustomed to running with, you know, five cars in the past. So
sure.
Doing a satellite operation with Shank and Jack Harvey, you know, I think that will, on the personnel side at least, that'll alleviate some of the strain. But you know, Mike Shank is one of the best team owners in sports car, and has always been a big part of Open Wheel through the days when I was coming through Atlantic, and got a lot of respect for him. I just drove for him, you know, at the 24 Hours of Daytona and the NSX. I drove for him in the Daytona prototype in the past. Great guy, great team leader. So it's good to have him part of it as well. And obviously, you know, the Alonso side of it goes without even saying. It's great for our sport, and you know, I really admire him doing it. I mean, geez, he doesn't need to stick his neck out like that for where he is in his career and how much he's accomplished. Certainly one of the best drivers in the world, and you know, for him to have that hunger and really want to come and take part in, you know, in the Indy 500, which is such a historically important race, not only in the racing world, in the automotive industry, and sporting in general. So, but if I look at it from a competition standpoint, it's more data, it's more information. Sure, those guys are going to be leaning on the other, you know, regular full-time four of us for information, but you know, it's something where we can, as the week goes on, the second week comes in, qualifying, we can all work together, I think, at that point, and benefit each of the cars.
So you have become a perennial Indy 500 favorite. What are your thoughts so far this year on the team? I mean, last year 500 was strong. There are a couple of individual races that were strong, but Andretti Autosport, you know, definitely ended the year realizing that there needed to be some improvements. Looks like you guys are really strong through two rounds so far. Is that is there that same feeling shared within the team, or are you seeing that, hey, you know what, we can just about go anywhere, and it seems like I think we should have a shot?
No, absolutely. The team's done an incredible job just to turn around in the first couple races. The tests as well. We've had some you know, encouraging pace to tests at tracks that we weren't so strong at years past, or the past couple years, I should say. But I know better than to jump to conclusions. We're only round two. We have a long way to go. You know, if you look back a year ago, we finished third at St. Pete, and we had a very frustrating weekend at Long Beach. Well, we had the same pace at St. Pete, and we went back and turned the program around at Long Beach. So, you know, we're checking the boxes off. Things are going in the right direction. And certainly the team has a new direction that seems to be a positive at the moment. But we have a lot of work to do. You know, I'm taking it session by session, race weekend by race weekend. Like I said, being careful not to jump to any conclusions, you know, early in the season here.
Sure.
You know, we fully expect to be on the pace at the 500 as well. But year to year, you know, we have different our competition making strides in other areas, and you can never really count on. You know, on years prior. So I think the outlook is positive right now. The team has a good, you know, good energy within it, and the teammates are all working really well together, and I think as a program we're off to a good start, but that's what it is so far. It's off to a good start.
Long Beach, I thought that I saw something that will probably become a familiar dynamic, and that was you and Rossi just being there, you know, together, running hard, close to each other. Not as if you guys didn't end the 2016 season that way. I mean, the two of you were kicking ass at Sonoma for sure, but you know, obviously there were some engine problems outside of everyone's control, but I thought Long Beach gave a really good glimpse into what could be an incredibly strong and consistent 1-2 punch wherever we go. And I'm also looking at Sato, who, you know, coming off of having Munoz in there, who is obviously very strong, it seems to me like Takuma's really fitting in and surprising me somewhat with the, you know, consistency and value that he's bringing. You think that there's, you know, at least some embers here that could heat up a little bit as the season goes on with this new full-time four-driver rotation?
I think that's a good point. And the most important aspect of all of that is we're pushing each other. I mean, Marco's been doing a great job. He's on the pace. Alexander, Takuma, we all know Takuma's, you know, as fast as it gets. And he's putting it together as well. So every session that we're out there, you know, your teammates are going to be pushing hard, and they're going to be putting down lap times capable of being at the sharp end of the grid. So it pushes you as an individual further as well, and as a team, I think that's a good thing. We just keep building on it, and we keep pushing each other. That's the ideal situation that a four-car team's looking for, is four fast guys continually pushing each other, getting the most out of their individual efforts. And I think that's happening. I mean, like you said, Rossi and I were right there at the front at Long Beach. Sato was really fast in practice, had a slip-up for some reason qualifying. I forget what it was, but Marco was also at St. Pete and through testing and Long Beach, right up there at the sharp end as well. So,
yeah,
we're all definitely pushing each other, and that's important.
So with Mr. Fernando Alonso coming in for the Indy 500, idiots like me are probably going to be paying a lot of attention because, you know, trying to tell a new story. It's not often you get a two-time Formula One world champion in the middle of an F1 season saying, hey, I'm going to go to a Speedway Indiana for a couple weeks and play over there.
Yeah, no doubt.
How do you manage, or how do you anticipate managing having, you know, 50 photographers piled on top of you guys when you do your end of day, you know, kind of group catch up at whomever's pit stand on pit lane or otherwise? I mean, I have to believe just doing what you do is going to be a little bit more complicated. Same for the rest of your team, with really heightened media presence and also fans wanting to turn up. Is it a good thing? Is it a bad thing? You just deal with it knowing it's, you know, all in the greater good for the sport?
No, I think it's a great thing. You know, my bottom line is always, as long as we can give our four full season cars, you know, the effort, the attention to detail that they deserve, I think the added attention and the, you know, bringing someone in, you know, for instance, like Fernando, is a great opportunity. I mean, we saw that, you know, be successful with Kurt Busch, and Townsend Bell certainly had a lot of pace as well. Yeah, do I think it's going to be a larger crowd, more traffic to get through outside the Andretti garage? Absolutely. But when you know it's good for the team, you know it's good for the sport, it's good for the Indy 500, it's good for IndyCar racing. You know, I'm just really happy to see the sport that I love, the series that I love, gaining traction like this and heading in the right direction. It's trending upward, and that is very important to me. You know, I came through karting when IndyCar was in its heyday, and these guys were the biggest, baddest, you know, names on the planet. Then the split happened right as I'm coming through Skip Barber, and, you know, it was, we were adrift at sea there for a while. So it's nice to see such strength, continuing strength in the series and in our future direction.
Only thing that bums me out is reading Lewis Hamilton's comments that he wouldn't be interested in our 500. He'd be more interested in doing the Daytona 500. And I'm like, come on, man, you're killing me here. But, you know, maybe Fernando runs well and talks it up enough. Maybe we'll get Lewis involved and, you know, we can make space. We need room for Vettel and Hamilton and you name it. You know, trust me.
I think Hamilton said that, and he said it based on the same angle of approach as Daniel Ricciardo, but Ricciardo may be better when Ricciardo said, you know, I'd love to do the Indy 500, but I think I might have to a talk to myself in the mirror and work up some courage before I go do that. It's definitely a riskier deal. You know, Jimmy Johnson has expressed interest in doing it. Really, I know he wants to do it, and I don't think, honestly, I don't know if his family wants him to do it. It's a riskier deal, no doubt. It's open wheel cars traveling at 240 miles an hour. I mean, we're doing almost 240 going into turn one in the draft. So, you know, in an open cockpit car with a fence, no doubt. Oval racing is the most dangerous form of closed circuit racing in the world. And I think that's the approach from the F1 side of the mentality, I should say. And that's what Ricardo, he articulated. And I believe that is also Lewis's bottom line.
Amen to that.